We want to give Reggie maximum time this morning, and it just is a real thrill to be able to welcome him to Ealing Bible Week. Reggie McNeil serves as Missional Leadership Specialist for the Leadership Network of Dallas. He's pastored local church at the Coalface and served as a consultant to churches and ministries in the U.S. and across the world. And it's a real joy for us. His books, Missional Renaissance and The Present Future, have had an impact right across the church. And I know that he loves to engage people with how to work with God in shaping church. Reggie?
I haven't read them myself.
Oh, you haven't read them? Okay. I think there are even some copies outside for you afterwards. Yeah. Welcome, Reggie McNeil. Great. Bless
you. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. It's absolutely terrifying, of course, and intimidating for a Baptist to be in a room full of Pentecostals. I mean, we've learned how to operate our churches without the Spirit. And so, you know, especially over on my side of the pond, I mean, so, and we're getting exactly what we can produce. So I need to come and be exposed to a little bit. And if you find yourself not agreeing with something that I say or whatever, I really didn't mean that. I just let the Spirit translate it for you. I'm very honored, actually, to be anywhere, but especially to persecute Christian leaders of a new tribe. And you're 100 years old next year, and I expected to run into some founding members. But I'm sorry I can't be here on your centennial, but I think you should be very glad that you've survived 100 years. You've been part of what the Spirit's been trying to say as a corrective to the Western Church, but I want to kind of nudge that a little bit today, if I can. We're in a very unusual time, of course, and I'm a little terrified. You know, video adds 50 pounds. We're aware of that. I just now realize what's going on behind me. But I want to, you know, everyone tells us, and how many years now have we heard this is a life-changing time, we're in one of these hinge points of history? It's all true. But, you know, I like your theme, because the church has been here before. As early as the book of Acts, just verses after the birth of the church, the church is having to play catch-up to the Spirit. It's not as if we've never been behind and lagging. It happens throughout our history, and then there are huge times in church history, and particularly Western church history, where there have been these momentous shifts. And 500 years after the birth of the church, you have Augustine sitting there in North Africa, And the Huns just aren't at the gate. They're inside ransacking the city, and the fall of the Roman Empire, and everything's changing. Everything is absolutely the civilization as the world knew it then was crumbling. But out of that kind of crumble, you get Augustine's work, you know, De Trinitate and City of God, and theological concepts and constructs that shape the theological discussion for 1,000 years. I mean, Luther is an Augustinian monk. Calvin studies Augustine. So fast forward 1,000 years from then, and you have now not this, just the collapse of the Roman Empire, but it's the Holy Roman Empire. And so the reformers are at work in that time where the center's collapsing, and the rise of the nation state is ongoing. And so they're reimagining the church. And so for the last 500 years, we've been living out, literally, in a sense, the shadow of the work of that group of people who said the church has to be something different in this time that we're living in, the whole birth of the modern era. But now here we find ourselves again 500 years later, and it's time, and it seems that the Spirit is having a conversation with the Western Church that I just want to reflect to you and some of the implications for it. And so, because the truth is, for 500 years, we have been at work fixing the church in the West. I was with a group of Lutherans last year on Pentecost Sunday, which is a big deal for Reformation Sunday, which is a big deal for Lutherans, and the horns are blowing, and Speaking of blowing, is anyone else hearing that noise? Is that the air conditioning? Well, then I'm very grateful for it. I just didn't know if I was still living in the last song. I thought the band would never quit. Just on and on and on. Jesus got it the first time. I'm just messing with a band. I don't know where they are, but they're out on a smoke break somewhere. I mean, I sat through their stuff. I don't know why they can't sit through mine. just messing. I know they'll get even. I'm a little terrified by this. What was I saying anyway? And what difference is it? As long as that's not heat I'm hearing, we're fine. So, thank you. I appreciate your listening up to this point. If I have to be where I am every time I speak, it would just be terrifying. So these Lutherans on a big day, I said to them, they bring me in to kind of be the deconstructionist. I said, you Lutherans have been at work fixing the church for 500 years. How's it working for you? And the truth of the matter is we've been in a church-centric era that has, as time has gone on, become, I think, problematic. And I think what's happening is we're fixing to move into, or we are moving into, a different conversation as the church thinks of ourselves into the future. Because what's happened is, in a church-centric era, it's been all about the church. In fact, I'm speaking at a place in about a month, and they just sent me the titles of all the other speakers. And one of them is speaking, see if this doesn't say it. One of the speakers has the primacy of the church, and that's followed by a speaker that talks about, the title is The Importance of the Kingdom. That's exactly backwards. You see, it's not about the church. We're not the fourth member of the Trinity. I mean, the mission of God was underway centuries before there was a church. I mean, we start the Bible with no church. We end in a garden with no church. We end the Bible in a city with no church. It made very plain. And so, we're not forever. We have a particular mission, or we are part of God's mission, which predates us and will go on into it. It's not about, it's the primacy is about the kingdom. Now, I don't know why I'm talking to a bunch of folks in Britain about kingdoms as an American. But you have a 1,000-year history, unending loyalty, and fine rapport with your king. But we have it so much. But you have this. You have a notion. This notion of kingdom is the big story. And I think in the West, it's what the Spirit is trying to bring the church back around to. And it has enormous implications for everything. In the leader streams today and tomorrow, some of you will be a part of those. I'm going to talk about leading a movement. You see, the kingdom is a movement. The church has institutional kinds of, but you started 100 years ago as part of a movement, a street movement, and we've got to get back to that, or we're never going to be able to catch up to the Spirit and catch up to the mission that God is at work in. And so I'll trot out a few of the implications for that and just leave it there and then unpack it a bit in our smaller sessions. But I think what is happening is that as time has gone on and with our focus on ourselves, we have in fact been running in worse cases, not you, I'm just thinking about Presbyterians and other groups. Almost a counter mission or a competitive mission to the real mission. Because God is always at work building his kingdom. And as a matter of fact, the kingdom of God is doing just fine. I tell leaders this all the time. It's like Christian leaders need to have some kind of sweaty-palmed anxiety about it's all up to us. It's not up to us. We're not in charge of the kingdom of God. The king is in charge of the kingdom. And he's doing just fine. He's relaxed about this. He's not anxious. He's not worried. He's not in a hurry, and he's not behind. He's exactly where. But you see, he cut us in on the deal. And that is, if he has an anxiety, or if we have an anxiety, it ought to be, are we doing our part of this stuff so that we can, you know, be exactly what we're supposed to be, so that we get the benefit of this. You see, the kingdom is a street movement. The kingdom is about the lame walk, the blind see. The lepers are made whole. It's about abundant. Like the kingdom is about life. It's not about an institution. It's not about religion. Oh my gosh, the most religious place in the world is hell. I mean, because religion is anti-God. I mean, religion is the substitute for the real thing. And it's a pathetic substitute. And even when we wrap religion around the core of what we do, it gets in the way. And so the kingdom is very simple. It's life as God intends. The life that God intended for you, the life that God intended for me, the life that God intends for all people, this abundant life thing. I mean, we start, again, a Bible with a tree of life. We end in the city with a river of life and trees of life on both sides that bloom for life is the point, and the kingdom is all about life. And so everything we do to enhance life is a kingdom participation with us. And unfortunately, I'm afraid, is the more that we focus on how we're... I'll give you an example. I should finish a sentence is what I'm really thinking. I'll just pick one and try to ride it all the way through. When I go to a place and all of the talk is about our church's vision, see, that's problematic. Because it's not about our church's vision. First of all, we don't own the mission. The church doesn't have a mission. The mission has a church. And it's not our vision and ask God to come bless our vision and get in on what we're doing. This is completely backwards. In fact, we're taught to pray over in my part of the world, you know, the sinner's prayer and all that kind of stuff. You probably don't have to fool with that over here. But you know, so we ask Jesus into our heart. We invite Jesus into our life. How backwards is that? We are invited into Jesus' life, not the other way around. What is that vine and branches thing about anyway? We're not the one pushing the life. We're not the one with life. The only thing we bring to the equation is death. And he brings the life and begins to expunge the death in us. And every place that the darkness is pushed back and every bit of anti-life that gets squelched out of my life and the lives of our communities and stuff is how the kingdom advances. We are an invasion group. We are invading the kingdom of anti-life. And we're not even having to introduce. See, I think our language gets in the way. We think that we've got to share. For instance, when we talk about the gospel, so many times in my part of the world, it's the gospel of the church or it's the gospel of the gospel. It's not the. Jesus came preaching the gospel of the what? The kingdom. It is announcing good news. We get to declare to people, we are releasing prisoners who are chained up. We are invading territory, setting people free, announcing the good news of God, which is he's for you, he's not against you. You don't have to live like this because he's already taken care of this stuff. So if it's sin or disease, all of the stuff that diminishes life in any way, in any form, he's at work redeeming. And he is setting people. So our privilege, we just get to announce stuff to people. We think we're trying to sell something. Are you kidding? We're not having to market the kingdom. We're not having to market the gospel. We just get the privilege of announcing it to people, and people self-select in their response to this and how they receive this and whether they want to, you know, we just get to announce jailbreak. but we didn't unlock the door. And so this whole kingdom kind of discussion is leading us into some new kinds of territory. And we're just seeing the front end of it. For instance, see, for 1700 years in the West, we've had kind of like one way to get to set up gospel in a town and set up church and kind of invite people. And it's been our congregational modality. So we formed congregations. Now, this was not, the congregation was not the first life form in the Christian taxonomy. I mean, there's a, you know, what was the first life form? Early church. It's okay, you can talk back some. Yeah, a house church. And as a matter of fact, in most parts of the world where we sing Pentecost every hour, it is the predominant life form today. But and I'm not here to make a pitch for this, you know, let's quit congregating. Please don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying we're going to abandon the congregation or all that, but what I am suggesting to you is we've had one way that we've been able to kind of allow people this one on-ramp onto the M5. And it's the congregation. And if you didn't come through the congregation, and if, as a matter of fact, when you made a decision to become a Jesus follower, if you didn't show up at the congregation, how did we know you were serious about it? And so all of the scorecard has been congregational scorecards. How many folks are come on Sunday? How much money did they bring? How big is our gathering? You know, how busy are we as a congregation? All of this scorecarding stuff that's built around one expression. In a kingdom expression, we're going to have to broaden the bandwidth of how we think church looks. Because you see, if in fact, because you see, for 500 years, with all of our concern about figuring out how to do church right and do church better, you know, all we've gotten in the West is a greater disaffection for church. Now, sometimes we got to wake up and smell the coffee on this. In fact, in my country where I roam around, as I say, you know, and from tribe to tribe over there, we have the best churches you can build. I mean, we've got the best churches we've ever had, and you have them here in the UK. I mean, I speak in these Six Flags Over Jesus kind of Disney World kinds of experiences every week. We have laser light shows. We have smoke, so we know when the spirit comes in. It's even color-coded now for the liturgical year, so we know exactly, kind of keep up. We have children's wings. You don't have to take your kids to Disney World anymore. Just get them to the children's wing. I mean, we have executive chefs. Not just chefs, executive chefs. I mean, we got to go. We know how to do church. See? If that was going to bring in the kingdom, it already would have. So he said, instead of a focus on it, we got to. So there surely is another chapter here. There's something. All right, so all of our church scorecard is not an adequate reflection of the work of God in the kingdom. And so I'm suggesting that what we're seeing as we move into this kingdom, we're going to have to, is again, broaden our bandwidth of how we think church. The big question for us now is not how to do church better, it's how to be church better. And that's about being church where people already are. You see, the number of people that are susceptible to being congregationalized in my country, and I suspect, here in the UK, is a dwindling number of people, because not that many people can order their lives around the rhythms of congregational life. I mean, congregation, we're familiar with, we're used to every 7 days, we're paid to do it. Every 7 days, you know, a complete business cycle as we go through the same. Many folks don't go through everything important in their life every 7 days. And there are an entire industries of people that you don't want to show up at your place on Sunday. The hospitality crew, the folks operating restaurants, what would happen if they closed down and showed up? We would starve to death on our way home from our club meetings. I mean, how would we get through if we didn't have, you know, donuts on the way? Or the healthcare folks, we're going to shut down all the hospitals so they'll, you know, empty out and come to church. I mean, these are entire pockets and you know, tribes of people that we're not looking for. We'd be terrified if they came. The issue is how can we be church where they already are? Instead of how to interrupt their lives, ask them to change their rhythms, actually ask them to be missionaries, change their language, change their customs, change their life in order to get the gospel. We've done it so long, though, it feels normal to us. And we think that's what evangelism is, and that's what sharing the gospel is. I am suggesting to you that is a church-centric mentality that is limiting the capacity for you and me to get in on the bigger story. And so what's going to happen, and it already is, your movement is already a part of it, missional communities and house churches and people figuring out how to be, you know, how to form a Christian community right where they work, where they live. And we've got to figure out a way to celebrate that and not make folks feel like they're not quite grown up yet if they don't come to church on Sunday. We're going to have to figure out a way, your movement's going to have to figure out a way, and you're at work on this, I'm aware. In all of these new experiences, how do we incorporate that if we want to celebrate what God's up to? But how do we not force that into a mold of one way that we do things? Now, I know that you wouldn't be at the Bible conference if you didn't believe that. But I'm saying that we're going to have to be even more open, because I'm pretty sure that we're just seeing the first of new life forms in the church. And it's going to take a whole bunch more for the gospel to be in every crack and crevice, for us to join the King where he is moving in every sphere of life. I'll tell you, I think we're going to have to be open to forms of micro church where people in onesies, twosies and threesies, you know, figure out ways to be, you know, missionaries right in the spot. We're going to have to figure out ways where at the macro church level, those of you who are really good at congregational life, in order to join the King in the kingdom, are going to be forming more cross-domain collaboratives to work together as the body of Christ in your town to make a difference, instead of this church, that church, this church, that church. Because God doesn't look at this church, that church, this church. He looks at the church. And so a kingdom keeps us from being competitors with each other. It might actually move us to figure, how can we affirm and celebrate the gifting and all that we bring together and work together as the body of Christ to call a party for a better community? And in our country, though, that kind of collaboration from the church, that's not what we're used to announcing to people how they need to behave, how they need to straighten up, how they need to get fixed, or join us and whatever, instead of moving in collaboration with folks to figure out how do we raise literacy, how do we, I'll give you an example. I was speaking with a guy just the day before I flew here. A congregation that runs less than 500 people. So it's not a huge, huge deal. It's significant, but not huge. But it's in one of our cities. In the roughest, he made a choice 10 years ago to go into the roughest zip code, postal code, in his city, the most crime-ridden, the most depressed, shuttered buildings everywhere, absolute, you know, just inner city urban decay. 10 years ago. And he went in with the idea that God has assigned us the mission field of this zip code. And he went in with less than 20 people. But here's what's happened over 10 years. I just cut to the chase. Because he didn't go in to start a church. You don't have to start a church. See, church's already here. See, we use words like church planting. I doubt it. I mean, church is already here. God's already deployed his folks. We're always catching up to where the church is. In fact, we think movements come out of, if we plant enough church, we'll get a movement going. It's exactly the opposite. Church grows out of a movement, not the other way around. And so what we're doing is we're planting the kingdom. Church grows out of that. So he decided he's not going in to just form a congregation. He's going in to live, heavily influenced by incarnational theology and got to be there with people and CCDA, Christian community, in our world, all this. So he moves in, and Mark, here's the result of it, is that they've brought over 190,000 square feet of shuttered building back to life in not just a church building. Oh, no. Only a small part of that is used by the congregation that gathers there. He's been busy building retail, bringing real retail back, creating jobs for people. Because, by the way, the Gallup folks who study this stuff, senior scientists say having a full-time job is the number one correlative to a person's sense of well-being. Trump's family, Trump's faith. Well, holy cow, that makes us nervous, because we think the number one sense is they're a member of our church. That should be their number one sense of well-being. Not if they don't have a job. And I'm talking about 30 hours with benefits, not this zero stuff that gets, or in our country, 20 hours a week so you don't have to have health care. I mean, I'm talking about a real job, real benefits. And so, I ask a lot of church leaders in our country, how many jobs are you creating? They look at me and say, you mean how many people can we put on our staff? No, that's not what I'm talking about. That's church-centric thinking. How many jobs are we creating? Microeconomic development, social entrepreneurship, whatever it takes to get people into a better life, a more abundant living. That's all a part of that. So Mark, over 90 jobs, 300 square feet all told, 190 now, and within a year it'll be over 300 square feet that's been brought back to life in retail in this area. Crime is down 10%. These are, if we're going to be kingdom-centric folks, we're going to have the courage to hook our scorecard to how our communities are doing, not to how well our gathering is getting along on Sunday. See, that's the big implication. But you see, those skills are not what we trained for, to be community development folks. I mean, I went to seminary to learn how to parse the Bible, how to do an archaeological dig through Scripture, ferret out some old information of how God worked centuries ago. I learned how to manage an institution well enough not to get in more trouble than I was going to. I learned how to do all the church, but leading a movement, blessing a community, these are new deals. These are new skill sets for people that want to be kingdom leaders. And some of us are feeling a bit overwhelmed when we think about that. No, don't throw that on me. I just need to pastor the flock. If you want to be church-centric, go on. But if you decide you want to be a kingdom leader, then you're not called to pastor a flock. You're called to pastor a community. And that's a total different deal. But it takes courage to do that. It takes a real reorientation in our scorecard. It's not about office hours and producing. I mean, so many of you, so many people in the West, Christian leaders, answered a call to help people. And suddenly we've turned into sermon factories and project managers and program directors. And there's something in our souls that says, you mean this is it? That we do all this activity and we hope somehow people fall out on the other end of growing disciples? And you know in your gut, in your heart, in your spirit, there's got to be more to this. Because this is not feeding your soul. Of course it's not. This is not about life. It's about busyness. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying you're not going to have programs and all that kind of stuff, but I'll have to sort through that later. Because I just realized what time it is. And y'all are going to have to listen a little bit quicker than you have been so far. And if you'll quit interrupting, I can get this done. I mean, you understand that this whole thing of the church calling the party is why we are here. If God's people don't call this party in our communities, who can? See, we're the people of joy and hope and confidence, because our confidence is not in the government to pull this off. Were we ever, really? Our confidence is not even in us to pull this off. We're confident, of all people in your community, no one else should have more joy, no one else should have more hope, no one else should have more assurance. We are the people that can call this party and say, there's nothing that we cannot, accomplish together under the power of the Spirit. For holy cow. Only if we have the mentality, though, that the church is not doing so well. So, maybe the church is, institution's not doing so well because we've not figured out how to be church. Just a thought. I want to use some scripture, because some of you by now have decided I'm not a Christian. Because if you're feeling a bit overwhelmed and saying, this is not what I signed up for, you're right. But God must have had a lot of, you could have been born in any other time, but where if you just didn't spill the juice and you just passed, you're okay. But that's not the time you're in. And our confidence has to come not from, even our grasp of the situation, but in a God who is not caught off guard by our circumstances. And so in Isaiah, it always helps to use an Old Testament prophet. You just cut through some of it. You have the people of God weren't counting on being in bondage as long, or away from the homeland as long, wanting to get back, all that kind of stuff. And there's a little bit of generational nya-nya going on among the refugees there in Babylon, about the good old days, and some of the folks that started the movement are dying off. And their memories of how it used to be in Jerusalem when the priests would show and the trumpets, all that stuff. And always throughout Israel's history, there's always a tension between the priests who want to settle down and just operate the religion and the prophets who keep coming in to say, our mission is, although the whole earth is mine, we are a special people. We're supposed to be priesting the world. It's the prophets that always keep banging Israel on the head saying, our mission is for them, not for us. The priests always turn it in. Settle down. Let's make sure we can do the sacrifices right. Get the worship done and decently. It's always this tension. So Isaiah steps into the middle of this yang-yang back and forth. And he speaks on behalf of God and carries the words of God. You're reading them already. And God says, can we not have a discussion about the past, please? Forget the former things. Don't dwell on the past. See, I'm doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I'm making a way in the desert. Streams in the wasteland. Now, what's interesting to me about church people is we always think that God is caught off guard by new stuff. As if the digital, information revolution is a struggle for him. And social media is kind of he's getting his toe in the water on that one. This notion of God is old is so non-biblical. I understand we have pictures of Sistine Chapels and stuff and long flowing, and I know he's been around a while, but this idea that you associate old with God is why not the image of God in his strapping youth? Like some of us at the height of our game. And so God says, you know, and because I can tell you that when God says, I'm doing a new thing, back to those, it was not the first time he did a new thing. Creation is new. Now, I know it's kind of, you know, it's old to God, you know, in one sense, and kind of, but creation is new in the sense that, there, and it's hard to talk about a time before there was, there just wasn't, and then there is, you know what I'm saying? God just speaks in this. Human beings are new. We have the diary entry from the you know, the Trinity discussions. Let's make a creature we can live inside. My goodness. This has never been done before. I mean, God has, you know, however many angels can fit on the head of a pin screaming at him all day long and praise and stuff, but a human being. So Adam is a brand new deal. And even the way that God creates Adam is new. Speaks the cosmos into existence. Speaks this, speaks that. Gets ready to create human beings. And what does he do? Gets his hands dirty. Gets down in the mud. Then he kisses Adam to life. Is that beautiful? Eve was new too. If you don't believe that, just ask Adam. He'd seen the rest of this stuff. Don't you know that had to be a way to go God moment? You know, when he came up on Eve. Whoa. And then throughout, you know, God will even do repeat stuff, but do it in new ways. See, God is not a God of rut, of you know, ritual or ritual. I mean, so the Exodus experience begins when they come out of Egypt and they get to, you know, to the, you know, they get to the Red Sea. How does the Exodus experience starts with, you know, Moses taking a hard right out of Goshen and winding up at a dead end. The Red Sea's not on the way to anything. It's a detour. And I'm telling you that because a lot of times when God starts something new, it feels exactly like that. Wait a minute, God. I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be over here. I did exactly what you told me, and now I'm staring at this dead end. I mean, I don't know how long you've been in leadership, but if you've been there long, you've been where Moses was. This is why we identify with him so much, with everyone thanking him for his decision in leadership to bring them to this place. Yeah, thanks a lot, Mo. Appreciate you bringing us out here to die. Yeah, we had better food back at the other place and more items on the buffet. I mean, all that stuff that you know, that they just carp and carp at Moses about. We get that if you've been leading people very long. And so Moses, you know, looks a lot like Charlton Heston, don't you think? You know, just calm down and see what God's going to do. And by the way, underneath his breath, he said, and right about now would be a good time to do it. I mean, you got chariots coming, you got water in front of you, you got people griping. I mean, this just looks hopeless. And of course, then God intervenes and pulls off this fantastic water show. And the dry ground crossing, captured by, you know, several filmmakers. And they go across on this. Now, I mean, now, a generation later, by the way, Joshua hears, finally tells him, we're going into the promised land. And he gets the word, it's going to be a dry ground crossing. If I were Joshua, I know exactly what I would have done. I would have organized dry ground crossing seminars. I would have put the DVD in. Look, this is how it's going to happen. We're going to get right up to the water. This wind's going to come. This water's going to stack up on both sides. The fish going to swim. Look at it. You know, and I would want to volunteer to be in the front of the line because I want to see all that stuff. And I would have crested the hill with an ark on my back and say, holy cow, does God not know what time of year this is? It's flood stage. There's water everywhere. It's going to take a huge mop to get this sucker dried up. But I know how it's going to happen. So I'd go charging down the hill of the ark, bouncing on my back. And I would get right up to the water, and I think, and I would have gotten completely soaked. Because this time, God doesn't do the dry ground crossing the same way. It's not till the priests put their foot in. In fact, I think they're in it up to their necks. Because he dams the river up 17 miles upstream. It takes a while. Those guys were prunes by the time the water went down. They're just hoping this ark will float, you know, because we're going to have to ride this sucker out of here. I mean, you know, they got no forewarning. They don't they haven't they've not read the Bible yet. They don't know what's happening. It's pretty amazing. Now, why wouldn't God just do a dry ground crossing the way he's supposed to? Have you ever had that conversation with God? This is the way I'd like for you to do this. I've consulted him plenty in my prayer life. I think there are two reasons that God did it different. One is I think he has a great sense of humor. I'm counting on that, actually. But the second more is that, you know, every generation needs its own dry ground crossing. See, we can't live on the, I mean, we can stand on other people's shoulders and look over, but we can't, yeah, faith is not, faith doesn't come with battery packs. You don't store up faith. It's an active deal. As you respond to the word that you are given, that's how you build the faith muscle, because it's really hard to please God without faith. No, God keeps putting new stuff in our lives because it's impossible to please him without faith. So it forces us to use that muscle. So this is why new stuff is so inherent in what it means to be a Jesus follower and the people of God. We're supposed to always be on the cusp of the new, not protecting some relic of the past. You know? We're not supposed to be harbingers of a world that is dissolving. We are the announcers of a kingdom that is emerging. And new looks a whole heck of a lot better than that old stuff. And so, I've just gotten to Exodus or maybe Deuteronomy by now, but the Bible's full of this stuff of God doing. I mean, you tell me. I mean, incarnation. Who had dreamt that up? Was that, what a new thing. God had never sweated before. Trust me, I don't understand the miracle of this either. All I know is that God wrapping himself in flesh and that, you know, the God of light crawling through a dark birth canal and emerging and blinking and being in the bread of life, yelling for milk. Who could dream this up? This is why we know Christianity has to be a revealed religion. No one would make this story up. It's just amazing. God had never been constipated. Smell bad on a rough day. I mean, needed to sleep. This is all new. And of course, you own the market on the Spirit, so I don't have to tell you about Pentecost being new. I mean, in episode 4 of Star Wars, you've got Luke and the crew that he's trying to rescue off the Death Star, and the Millennium Falcon's out there. They're trying to get to a lightsaber fight breaks out over here between Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Obi-Wan, run, Luke, and, you know, over there in the, and then, so Luke watches, you know, Darth Vader Obi-Wan fold his lightsaber, power down, and Darth Vader, and that's the end of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Except those of you who are series aficionados know it's not the end of Obi-Wan Kenobi. he shows up just moments later in the cockpit. Luke making his final run to the Death Star. Luke. Trust the Force. Now, where would George Lucas get a storyline like that? I mean, on Good Friday, we just went through, the disciples saw Jesus fold his lightsaber. Ooh. And he's cut down. That'll end that. All the cackles of hell. And then there they are in the upper room. Luke. Matthew, Mark, John. No wonder they went nuts. I mean, this had never happened before. I mean, Jesus had a habit when he was wandering off, you know, and they, you go get Jesus, will you? Tell him it's time to kill this storm. Or, you know, wake him up. Or I mean, he just had now 24/7 access, this distributive network that the Spirit births at Pentecost. They only dreamed this. No one could imagine how that. This is all new. Do we have an old birth or a new birth? Are we going to an old heaven or a new heaven? We're going to have old bodies or new bodies? Hallelujah for that one. I was looking at you and I said that, but I don't. I mean, I've lost over 3,000 pounds. And I'm looking forward to not having to worry about that anymore. Are we going to have old clothes or new clothes? Old names or new names? And when John sees through to the throne and, you know, there in his vision on Patmos and the veil parts and the God of the universe says, behold, I'm making everything as renovated as possible with what I've got to work with. You know? Are you kidding? Brand spanking new. From Genesis to Revelation, new is the book on God. Now, I know those people in Isaiah's time, and I know people of all era, because people act like people all the time, and in every situation. They knew that he was talking about delivering them to the back to Jerusalem. Now, between Baghdad, where they were, in Jerusalem, there's miles and miles and miles of just desert. So they're thinking in their mind, I know, God knows their first reaction when he says, I'm going to deliver you back there. Their first thing is, we'll never make it. We'll die. We've got stories of people that died on their way here. We don't have enough water. Camels will not make it. So God says, look, I'm paving an interstate, a motorway. I'm actually putting service stations on the motorway, not like the M25. You just die out there and never. I'm putting Cokes at every rest stop. Streams in the desert. And I know some of us. You mean I have to be a community developer? You mean I have to actually learn how to practice my Jesus following on the street where people need healing and hope, and out from behind the pulpit, I got to be out there among real people? I know it's terrifying. But the God who says, I'm going to deliver you to that, I'm going to do that, our only response is one of confidence. Not in us, but just to say yes. And so when I say to you that the Spirit, that we're playing catch up to the Spirit, and the Spirit right now is having a different conversation with the Western church to move from a church-centric Christianity into a kingdom-oriented, kingdom-centric movement, there's only one confident response to make. Yes. Renew me. Renew us. Because after all, gang, as Jesus said, and I leave you with, fear not, little flock. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the... That's weak. He didn't say, I've come to give you church and give it to you more abundantly. He didn't say, it's the Father's good pleasure to give you the church. Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give you the hot dog. That's it.